Thank you very much, Lynn. Hopefully everyone can hear me okay. I am in St. Louis. Yes, okay, good, wonderful, wonderful. Yeah, I came here to do 2 3-day gatherings. One just wrapped up today. It was really Friday evening, all day Saturday, and all day Sunday. And then tomorrow I have, well, off, except that, in the morning I t teach an MPP class, and in the evening I have a member board trustee meeting, and in between there's other stuff I'll do. So it's off from gatherings, but I'll be just working from here in St. Louis. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday I have another 3-day gathering. And then Friday I come home. So that's what's happening here. The place I'm at, I'm at Irene Graham's house, and this house by far exceeded my expectations. It's an amazing house for what we're doing. It's a very nice house, but on one end of the house there are 2 bedrooms, one of which I have, which has a twin bed in it and a great big giant desk that goes like all the way around the corner, like an L desk. So I have a twin bed and an L desk and a closet, which is what I need, right, to do my work. And then, of course, there's a dining room and a living room and a kitchen with, lots of nice space, beautiful modern kitchen. But then on the other side of the house, there's another wing, and there's literally a conference room. There's a conference room with a little kind of, area where you can have coffee and tea and a refrigerator and a sink and then a bathroom and then this huge family room off of that. And outdoor there's a pool, but it's too cold for the pool. But it's really like a conference space. And I was really impressed to come here and find this conference space with a flip chart and chairs set up around the room. I never expected that. So the space is really quite perfect. What we've been doing is we've divided the participants up into 3 groups, and each day of the retreat, the participants, one group will bring the meal for everybody, and one person is organizing the meal. So it's not really potluck; it's a kind of a planned meal. So 1/3 of the participants brings the meal each day, so we get our lunch in the middle of the day, and it's just really working out wonderful. It's a very, very nice opportunity to have a retreat here, a very low cost retreat. And Irene and her family, they're so generous. Irene has signed up for the weekday, the coming up retreat, but she wasn't signed up for the weekend retreat. And her husband have literally been leaving every day and leaving the entire home and facility to us. Their generosity is incredible. And of course, she's providing all the coffee, all the tea, the flip chart, the paper plates, and the cups and silverware, and just there, she's just thought of everything. Everybody is so impressed. It's just like a you have a true conference center manager taking care of the logistics. She's just thought of everything, and it's they're just their generosity is just incredible. So that's what's going on here. Of course, we're here now for the 7 steps to awakening, and then immediately following this, there will be an Awakening Together member meeting. And then later on tonight, of course, I will come back for the Awakening Together daily contemplation. As far as the 7 steps to awakening go, let me paste this link in. We are starting with quote number 542. And as always, what I like to do is start with just a little bit of silence. So if y'all would join me in the silence, I'd appreciate it. Amen. All right, good, good, good. So I'll be using the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, and I will be reading the quotes from the book. And right now, the quotes that I'm reading are coming from Step 3. And actually, even before that, the place that the quotes were gathered from is the Garland of the Guru's Sayings by Muruganar. But of course, the teachings are attributed to Ramana Maharshi. That would be the Guru in this case. And then after that, I read the contemplation from my Seven Steps journal, which the link is in the room. But also, if anybody is listening on the radio, you can find the Seven Steps journal at RDA7. That is the digit 7. The word is not spelled out. RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. And again, we're going to be starting with number 542. So you would just click on step 3 once you get to the website, and then click on the numbering sequence that will allow you to find your way to number 542. And that's how you begin. I'm going to read number 542 first from the Seven Steps to Awakening. Unlike the ego, which rises and sets, the true self abides forever the same. Turn your back on the false ego and so destroy it, and then shine as the one self alone. First of all, when I look at this now, even before I go to the journal, I see a wonderful quote. There's a couple different things I see in it. When it says, unlike the ego which rises and sets, I kind of think of two things with the rising and setting. First of all, to some degree, the ego goes to sleep every night. The reason I say to some degree is because we also know that the ego can show up in our dreams. but there's that point of sleeping when we aren't dreaming. That point of sleeping that is very much like unconscious. In that point of sleeping, many masters have pointed out there is no I. There's no I thought in that type of sleep. It seems like I remember Muji saying to someone who was married, like, are you married when you're asleep? what's your nationality when you're asleep? I remember questions like this. And of course, what he was pointing out is when there's no thoughts, those identities don't exist. And in that deep, deep sleep, there are no thoughts. But then again, when you wake up in the morning, that identity comes back and all those thoughts come back. And so the ego rises again. But in addition to that, in addition to setting and rising when we go to sleep and when we wake up in the morning, there's also the thought about at the end of the lifetime, at death, the ego sets. And then at the beginning of a new lifetime, at birth, the ego rises again. So it's interesting how the ego can kind of go away and then rise again, set, like a sunset, and rise again. But this is saying that the true self, however, is constant. It doesn't set and then come back again, right? Again, the quote says, unlike the ego, which rises and sets, the true self abides forever the same. And then I love this second sentence. In fact, the second sentence actually kind of gets me excited. I love the second sentence. It says, turn your back on the false ego and so destroy it, and then shine as the one self alone. Some people don't like words like destroy, destroy the ego, because what they think destroy means is attack. They think they have to battle with the ego and fight the ego. And anybody who knows anything about the ego knows that won't work. If you fight the ego, battle the ego, you are engaging the ego. And when you engage the ego, you actually enliven it, right? But what I love about this, even though it uses destroy, is the method for destroying. Turn your back on the false ego, right? It kind of reminds me of the teachings of Inner Ramana that says just lose interest in it. Lose interest in it. And when you are, this is the opposite of attacking it. I mean, this is not engaging it. Where attacking is aggressively engaging it, this is not engaging it. And it's really saying that through not engaging the ego, that's how you destroy it, right? Which kind of changes the feeling of the word destroy, if you think about it. No longer does it have that connotation of attack. So turn your back on the false ego. And so destroy it. And then shine as the one self alone. So that's the quote. And what I would like to do is go look at the journal and just see what I wrote when I contemplated this in July of 2012. I asked the question, what changes? And actually, I can sit in that question for a bit of time. If I ask, what changes, depending on, you know, where my attention goes first, I might see that the world changes. You know, I might look out first and see that the world changes. If I ask again, what changes, I might come a little closer and I might notice that my family changes, my life situation changes. What I call my life never stays the same. It changes, and it always has. If I ask again, what changes? I might come a little closer and notice that my body changes, right? It's, you know, over time, it seems to grow up and then begin the process of growing old and gain weight and lose weight. And sometimes it's healthy and sometimes it's ill. If I ask the question again, I might notice that my emotions change. Sometimes the emotions are happy, excited, eager. Sometimes the emotions are a little dull, a little bored, a little sluggish. Sometimes the emotions are angry, frustrated, annoyed, frightened, right? They don't stay the same. And if I ask that question again, what changes? I might notice that the mind really has some pretty drastic changes. I mean, sometimes there's lots and lots of thoughts. Sometimes those thoughts are, you know, really something that feels like confusion to me. Like, you know, I feel somehow lost in that thinking. I feel confused, lost from whatever comforts me. Sometimes those thoughts feel a little more solid, a little more secure. I'm a little more confident. I'm a little more at home with my thoughts. I feel a little more found. Sometimes my thoughts are clarity that might even seem, you know, either beyond me or I really feel at home. You know, like that's me. That's the real me, right? But they don't seem to be the same. What changes? When I ask that question now, I come up with kind of an emptiness. So I must have asked the question enough. What changes? I looked at the world. I looked at, quote, my life, the body, the emotions, the mind. So then I go back to number 542 in the journal. It says, what changes? It is not real. disregard everything that changes and abide firmly in what remains. Well, we already saw from the quote that the way to destroy the ego is not to attack it, not to engage it in that way, but just to turn your back on it, to lose interest in it. And now what we're seeing is that we really want to disregard everything that changes. That means I don't really want to give thought to the world. You know, my attention thought, my figuring out about, my thinking about, my being concerned about, because the world changes. I don't really want to give thought to my life. You know, my goings, my comings, my plan about what I'm going to do a year from now, or, you know, anything related to my life, because that changes. I don't really want to give thought to my body. I don't want to be thinking all the time about what foods I should eat or what vitamins I should take or worrying about the aging that's happening or any other type of thinking that maybe wants to go on about the body, because that changes and I'm being asked now to disregard everything that changes. The emotions. I don't really want to be engaged in trying to affect my emotions. I don't want to be engaged in trying to determine, you know, which emotions I like and which emotions I don't like and which emotions should be here and which emotions should not be here, and shifting from one emotion to another emotion. You know, if I'm doing that, I'm not disregarding them. I'm engaged with them. I'm trying to affect them. And then the last thing that changes was the mind. And it's kind of funny because in a way I've been talking about the mind all along. Because what thinks about the world and is concerned about the world, it's the mind. What thinks about my life and plans my life and, you know, is concerned about my life, it's the mind. What thinks about my body, decides how my body should be, and tries to make choices to get my body to be the way it should be, it's the mind. And what is happy with or not happy with a particular emotional energy? What decides that one emotional energy is good and one emotional energy is bad or should be avoided or should be got out of as soon as possible? It's the mind. So it's really the mind that needs to be disregarded. And in fact, if I look at each of these things that change and I notice the questioning process that happened, I kind of started with the outermost and worked my way into the innermost object that changes. The outermost object that changes was the world. And then a little closer was my life in the world. And then a little closer to inner was this body And then, a little closer, was the emotions. And then really, really close, so close that in most cases I can't even separate it from the thought of me. I can't even separate it from what I am. I'm so caught up in it, I think it is me, the mind. But now I'm asked to disregard everything from the mind outward. But I'm not just asked to disregard everything from the mind outward. I'm also asked to abide firmly in what remains. So if I take the mind and everything that is out from the mind, and I wad it up like a piece of paper, and I throw it into the fire, what's left? What is that clear space that I am? Isness, Susan says. That's my favorite word. This weekend they were telling me that isness is my business, Regina's business. Isness is my business, they were saying. Isness. Just being. What changes? It is not real. Disregard everything that changes. And abide firmly in what remains. And with that, we can scroll down if you're in the journal with me underneath the comment and reply area and click on number 543. And I will read number 543 from the Seven Steps to Awakening. Even as the ego does not die, unless the self's glance falls on it, the painful dream of this phenomenal world will never disappear unless the mind meets glorious death. I love the way Muruganar writes. I love his poetic expression. Again, these are the teachings of Ramana Maharshi, but expressed through Muruganar's poetry. Even as the ego does not die unless the self's glance falls on it, the painful dream of this phenomenal world will never disappear unless the mind meets glorious death. We know it's interesting in the previous exercise of asking what changes. Starting with the outer and working back towards the inner, we found that the last changing object in that lineup was the mind. We also found that, in effect, the only changing object was the mind, because we found that even though we were looking at the world and saying the world changes and deciding to disregard the world, the truth is that which thinks about the world is the mind. So we were really looking at the mind. Even as we were looking at, you know, my life and realizing that my life changes and therefore it is to be disregarded, what we saw is that we really needed to disregard the mind, because it's the mind that thinks about and plans and is concerned about my life. And the same thing was true with the body. It was the mind that needed to be disregarded. And the same thing was true with the emotions. It was the mind that thinks about the emotions and judges the emotions and decides which emotions are good or bad and which ones are enjoyable and not enjoyable. So although in one way we seem to be working our way back and we found that the mind was the closest object that needed to be disregarded, in effect, the whole thing was the mind. The mind was really the only object there. The only object that needed to be disregarded. This particular quote says again, even as the ego does not die unless the self's glance falls on it, the painful dream of this phenomenal world will never disappear unless the mind meets glorious death. The mind was the only thing that we were ever engaged with. We thought we were engaged with the world. We were engaged with our thoughts about the world. We were engaged with the mind. We thought we were engaged with my life. We were only engaged with my thoughts about my life. We were engaged with the mind, and so on with the body, and so on with the emotions. It's all the mind. And so if we disregard the mind, so that it's no longer being fed by our divine attention, and any apparent light that the mind has goes out, and the mind ceases to be, it vanishes. Then all those things also have to vanish because they never were anything but mind. That's all it ever was. If we go to number 543 in my journal, we see, do not feed the mind. Drop away from the mind in whatever way seems doable as often as possible. Mind dies through lack of attention. Self, which cannot die, reigns supreme. One thing that I think is really interesting about the journal entry is that the journal entry says to drop away from mind, and then it says, in whatever way seems doable, as often as possible. It's not concerned with the form of the spiritual practice. It doesn't really matter if inquiry leads me to unravel myself from the mind and then drop my attention from it, or if saying a mantra disengages me from the mind and allows me to drop my attention to it, or if noticing that which never changes, noticing that awareness and just watching it, awareness watching awareness, if that's how I take my attention away from the mind, it doesn't really care how. The journal entry doesn't. It doesn't really care how. It only asks us to do it in whatever way seems doable. And of course, as often as possible. And I don't know about you all, but one thing that I notice is sometimes what seems doable changes. You know, so sometimes there's the ability to focus on what we call awareness, that which never changes, and to watch that, and to give attention to that instead of the mind. But sometimes, for some reason, you know, whatever reason, that doesn't seem as easy to do. That seems like a struggle, like I have to try too hard. But maybe when that's the case, maybe I could say a mantra, you know, like, I am that I am. Or, be still and know that I am God. And then following the mantra, what I usually find is a silence. And maybe I can just drop into that silence and give my attention to the silence. Or maybe if I do feel all caught up in the mind, there's some story that's really running around and running around, and I can't even say a mantra and get to silence. You know, maybe I could practice inquiry. Another wonderful practice that, you know, I've discovered and have used, I discovered it first through Adyashanti and then secondly through Thich Nhat Hanh, is what Thich Nhat Hanh and I think many Buddhists call mindfulness, but it's actually using the senses to not pay attention to the mind. You know, because I'm paying attention to the sensory experience so much. You know, I'm paying attention to how my feet feel when I'm walking on the ground. I'm paying attention to really what the tree limb looks like as I look at the tree limb. I'm paying attention to really what the food tastes like as I'm feeling the food. But somehow in doing that, it's actually a tool where I'm not paying attention to the chatter of the mind. I'm actually in a quieter, more attentive, more aware space, noticing awareness more than mind. I love it when spirituality gets simple. I've always loved it when spirituality gets simple. I'm not a complicated spiritual girl. And to me, when it tells me just to disregard the mind, drop away from the mind in whatever way seems doable as often as possible, that gives me a real sense of freedom in that I know exactly what the task is. I even understand why. I understand that mind is fed by attention. And what I really do want to do is take my attention away from that mind. And I know myself. I know how much attention I give to that mind. I know how it chatters and I listen. So I understand that I am giving it attention and that's why it still lives, or at least appears to live. And I don't feel any guilt about that or any judgment about that. To me, it's just kind of a mechanical process and I get it. I get my part in it. I'm okay with that, and I am willing to change it too. And I like the freedom of being able to pick the tool that feels most doable now to accomplish the task. In fact, that feels like love to me. Do not feed the mind. Drop away from mind in whatever way seems doable as often as possible. Mind dies through lack of attention. Self, which cannot die, reigns supreme. And with that, I'm going to scroll down underneath the comment and reply area and click on number 544. Number 544 in the Seven Steps to Awakening says, "The true light of awareness, pure, subtle, egoless, non-objective, silent, which tires the mind and baffles it till it admits, 'I know not.' This is being awareness. This, the self." The true light of awareness, pure, subtle, egoless, non-objective, silent, which tires the mind and baffles it till it admits, "I know not." This is being awareness. This, the self. As I read the quote, I got some helpful meaning out of many, many, many of the words in the quote. You know, like, it starts off, "The true light of awareness, pure." Pure was the first word that I found myself looking at. In the Awakening Together Minister Preparation Program, in the Phase 1 class, which is called True Discernment, we talk about purification. And the way we define purification is the process of going from mixed to pure. So there's no judgment on the word purification, where like pure means good, right? And you're moving from evil to good, or bad to good, or guilty to good. We're just moving from mixed to not mixed, which is called pure. That's what purification is. So what is mixed? What is that mixed status? Well, pure is what some people would call awareness only, or isness only. It's that which never changes only. That's pure. Mixed is when you add all of the activity of mind and all of the effects of that activity to it. So when we're going through purification, we are learning to turn our attention away from, learning to detach from mind and all of the activity of mind, so that it ceases to be. And then once again, we have pure awareness. Not mixed. The second word that caught my attention in this particular quote was subtle. Subtle is a word I use a lot because, or at least with myself, I don't know if I say it to you all, but I use it a lot because it so perfectly points me beyond the mind to that which I am before mind. Because there's nothing subtle about the mind. I don't see the mind as subtle. I don't see the emotions as subtle. I don't see the body as subtle. In fact, the body is quite, is gross the word? I don't mean like sickening gross, but you know, like, I don't know. I can't think of any other words. I'll just say the mind is quite gross. That's the only word I can think of. You know, certainly my life does not seem subtle. It seems very vibrant. The world does not seem subtle. It seems very busy with a lot going on. You know, so the word subtle, if I really focus on that word subtle, oh, dense. Thank you, Teddy. That's the other word for gross. Yes, the body seems very dense, doesn't it? Yeah, thank you, Teddy. So the word subtle, when I focus on the word subtle, when I contemplate the word subtle, the word subtle literally helps tune me into that which is before the mind. Just the word itself. Because none of those objects are subtle at all. So I love the word subtle. It's a tool for me. Pure, subtle, egoless. That to me is an important word, egoless. Because if there's any ego at all, that is not the true self. The true self is completely egoless and has always been completely egoless. The true self is before the thought that began the ego. And that thought that began the ego never changed or affected the true self in any way. So I love that word egoless as a part of the list of words here that are pointing towards the true self. True, subtle, egoless. This next word I really love too, non-objective. And, you know, maybe I don't even know what the heck non-objective means, but I'll tell you what it means to me. It means not an object. That's what it means to me. There's only one thing, although the word thing isn't exactly appropriate, but you know how language is. There's only one thing that I can find that is not an object. It's another word that I can contemplate, right? Just like I can contemplate subtle and I can find the self. I can contemplate not an object. Not what's not an object. And, you know, through the process of neti neti, not that, not that, you can see that everything is an object. You can even see that your emotions are objects. How do you know they're objects? Because you can see them. You can witness them. You can choose to be engaged with them, or you can choose to not be engaged. You can choose to just be the observer of them. So they are an object. If you can make a choice about them, they're an object, right? And the mind is most definitely an object. I mean, you can be totally engaged in the mind, totally caught up in the mind, and not realize that it's an object. But you can also step back from it and look at it and watch it and even be amazed at its activity. It's totally an object. There's only one thing I can find that's not an object. And of course, the word thing, again, you know, becomes like a little bit of a joke. But when I look for the one thing that is not an object, I have that flash of self-realization. I know. You know, if I'm not looking for the subtle and the non-objective, I'm just like, you know, most everyone else I know. I forget and I get to thinking again that the mind is me. And in fact, my average stance is forgetting and acting like the mind is me. I'm kind of lucky in that my mind has been somewhat purified, in that, you know, I don't think the attack thoughts and the hate thoughts and the betrayal thoughts and the victim thoughts and, you know, all that stuff for some reason. Well, not for some reason, because I went through this purification process with a lot of gusto, a lot of willingness. A lot of those thoughts aren't there. So my mind is what you could call a very benign mind, which is nice because it means I don't suffer, you know, like some people suffer when they forget and they think they're their mind. You know, that's nice. But still, I forget. And what's really nice is when I contemplate words like subtle or not an object, and I leave forgetfulness for realization. That's precious. And of course, I like to spend time doing that every day. I told Irene this morning, Irene is the person I'm staying with here in St. Louis. I told her, I said, I'm very, very happy with this life that I have, this, life involved with awakening together. But I think I could also be very, very happy as a contemplative, someone who did nothing but contemplate and walk. Because during my contemplation time each day, I am looking at the subtle and the non-object. I am remembering myself. And that is the most precious time of day for me. Because that is the most precious experience. It's not an experience in the way some other things are experiences, because other experiences are temporary. This one is permanent. It just gets covered up again when I forget again. But I love remembering. And I think it's wonderful to love remembering, because I think that anything that we really love and cherish and we have gratitude for, that expands. So one thing I have a lot of confidence in, although I don't know when or I don't know how, but I have a lot of confidence that because I love my contemplation time and because I love realizing myself during that time, that someday, as Rabia said, someday realization will kiss me and never leave. I won't ever forget again. I won't ever think on the mind again. And I know that's going to happen, but until that does, I take that very special focus time every day, and then I remember as much as I can during the day. And I don't judge myself or condemn myself for when I forget. And I'm grateful that my mind is a purified mind. And whenever I find something in the mind that's not pure, because I am grateful that when I forget, at least I'm in a purified mind. If I find something that's not pure, I still practice the practices of purification. So let's see, we looked at pure, subtle, egoless, non-objective, silent. That's another word that can be contemplated in order to realize self. I used to misunderstand, just like a lot of other people misunderstand, I used to think that the mind would become silent. But now I realize that the mind is thought. In that way, the mind is the movement of thought. And the movement of thought does not become silent. Now, the movement of thought can disappear. The mind can go away. But as long as it still appears to be, it doesn't become silent, because it is movement. The mind is movement. It doesn't become silent. But if I contemplate the word silent or the word still, I can find that which has always been silent, always been still. It's never moved. And then I get that precious moment again. That wonderful, wonderful, precious moment of remembering who I am, of what I am, of knowing I'm not the mind or any of the things that the mind points to, like the emotions or the body or the personality And I can even sense what Jesus called eternal life. I can sense with an intuitive sense that this, which has always been quiet, is also always present. And that's wonderful. You know, that's wonderful. When I'm very, very aware of that, I can't even imagine anything else I would ever want. There are no desires in that place. The desires only come when we forget that place and we're back into the mind again with all of its movement. The true light of awareness, pure, subtle, egoless, non-objective, silent, I love this, which tires the mind and baffles it till it admits, I know not. What the heck does that mean? How does this pure, subtle, egoless, non-objective, silent thing that is not a thing at all tire the mind and baffle it till the mind admits, I know not? Well, it doesn't really. That's Muruganar's poetic expression. It doesn't move. It doesn't affect the mind or engage the mind at all, so it doesn't tire the mind. The mind really tires itself. When the mind begins to look inward instead of outward and try to grasp or define or own that which is before mind, it can't. No matter how hard it tries, it can't. And that's what tires the mind, is its failure to possess, its failure to be able to claim and define the light that comes before it. The true light of awareness, pure, subtle, egoless, non-objective, silent, which tires the mind and baffles it till it admits, I know not. This is being awareness. This, the self. So you see, the entire quote is nothing but a contemplation to help bring us, at least in the moment, what the Course would call a holy instant. An instant of pure realization without mistaken identity. And that's beautiful. But the only way that a quote can do that is if we take the time to really be in the quote, to contemplate the quote. An instant of pure realization without form, as Barb has written. Now, number 544 in the journal says, the mystery of self can be sought after, but the mystery of self cannot be found. This is really talking about the mind trying to grasp the light before it, define the light before it, own the light before it, control the light before it. The mind can try and try and try and try, but it can never do that. And yes, Wolfgang, I'm right here. Wolfgang, I'm right here. Yeah. So the mind can try and try and try and try, but it can never reach it. The mystery of the self can be sought after, but the mystery of the self cannot be found. Thus the word mystery, right? Realization of this fact mysteriously ends mind and reveals self. Somehow the mind, so I'm told, kind of self-destructs. And the search ends, the search ends. When the mind realizes the search is futile. The mystery of self can be sought after, but the mystery of self cannot be found. Realization of this fact mysteriously ends mind and reveals self. And you'll find, you know, there are definitely teachers who talk about the moment when they realized they couldn't do it, meaning from the mind perspective, they couldn't do it, they couldn't make themselves awaken. And then the awakening happened from the moment of realizing they couldn't do it. That surrender, that letting go of trying to do it from the mind. That was the end.